Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert. And Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing absolutely fantastic. It's our second episode of 2019, some 300 something. I don't know. We've done a lot of these shows. You know, last year, Dave, I mean, you just kind of wrapped up a bit of a mini series that we called How to Think Like a Front End Developer, which I have been working on, turned into a talk, and it's just been fueling a lot of my thought recently. And we kind of figured out, right, that there's, I don't know, there's a lot happening in front end development. It's the biggest thing going on the web. You know, it's just, it's unbelievable what front end developers are able to do these days. But there, it does seem to be a little bit of a divide. There's certainly people that are front end developers who are happily doing a bunch of work that isn't particularly JavaScript focused. And then a whole bunch of people that are doing work that's just absolutely all JavaScript all the time. Super deeply JavaScript. And it was, I guess, your idea to hone in on that latter half for a new bit of a mini series on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought, you know, if we erred on one side, it was more that front of the front end that Brad Frost talked about. And so now it's like, let's just go all JavaScript, like full blown JavaScript for whatever the next X number of episodes. So, we have a special guest today, sort of an umbrella project for the modern JavaScript, Henry Zhu. Hi, Henry. How are you?
Hey, glad for having me. Good, doing good.
That's fantastic. You know, Henry, you're you know, probably known for a number of things. Have a brand new podcast people can check out called hopeinsource.com, which is a wonderful name. That's kind of it says a podcast about faith and open source. You do a lot of thinking about open source, having one of the bigger open source projects there are, particularly in the world of JavaScript, and that's Babel, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's my full-time thing right now.
Full-time, and that's somewhat new, right? So can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It's funny. It's been so long now, I guess. I left my job at Adobe in March, I guess it was March 1st. So it's been over like 10, almost a year already. Yep. And I kind of just took the leap, which I guess looking back, I'm going to write a post about this, but I wouldn't suggest people randomly do that. but I guess I could say lucky or in a lot of ways. And now I can support myself. So
do you find that when people find that out, it's surprising? There's one person who makes their living off of Babel, despite it being absolutely ubiquitous in the world.
Right. I mean, I'm surprised all the time. I'm like, every time there's something that happens, I'm like, why am I the only one working on this full time? And then even not full time, it's like we only have like five or six people, like, you know, core maintainers that, you know, spend their volunteer time working on it. And then just thinking about the scope of what our project does, it's almost, in a way, it's sad, but also like, wow, it's still working and like people are using it somehow. But yeah, I think there's this overwhelming sense of like, there's a lot of work to be done. And that's probably why I have so much anxiety. So yeah. I'm technically like living the dream for a lot of people. Like, you know, I get to do quote unquote open source full time. And not have to worry so much about the money, at least at the moment, because, you know, at any point, maybe people just stop donating. But it causes me to think more about these other struggles of, like, managing your time and priorities and, like, you know, how do we set our boundaries and, like, helping people and, like, what should I even do, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. You're your own boss and it's not always the dream. I mean, I think even people that are just kind of like generic freelancers go through some of the same struggle. They're like, God, this is amazing. I don't have a boss. I can work from the beach if I want to. But it brings a whole new world of stressors, you know?
Right. No, exactly. And even just things that, well, I knew about them before, but there's one thing to think about and one thing to actually like live it out. So, you know, dealing with like insurance or like taxes and making a company, or should I even make a company? Like all those other things that you don't even need to think about if you're just working on it for fun.
Right.
And just thinking about not just the future of the project, but like how do I fit in that future? You know, should I code more or code less? And I'm finding myself like doing that less because I feel like the thing that we need is more I guess, quote unquote, managers type stuff.
Yeah, leadership.
And even that is like, I obviously don't know anything about that. I have no experience doing that other than through the context of this project. And maybe a lot of the struggle I have is just because I don't know what I'm doing and I have a hard way of judging if I'm doing it right.
It's not like you got six months, you can just take a break and just, you know, really bone up on your leadership skills, you know?
Right. And it's hard to get feedback, right? It's like, I don't have another manager. I can't like move up. There's no sense of, I don't know. It's just a lot of figuring things out and learning that it's okay to like fail, quote unquote. But I think the problem is with the open source, it's like, you know, it's all volunteer. And so a lot of it's kind of like this internal struggle of like, I feel like I might fail like the community or the project, like all the time. And at the same time, you're not even like directly making money from it. So it's like what you said, like, why do I feel like I can never take a break? When you're at your job, you're never thinking, oh, I'm making too much money or whatever. You're just like, you're trying to get a raise and stuff. And here I'm like struggling, like all these people are donating, maybe individual people or companies. And then I feel like bad that I'm like, you know, quote unquote, wasting my time. Like every minute has to be quote unquote productive. And it's like something I need to get over, but it's difficult.
Yeah, because it's self-imposed to some degree. If those people were unhappy, they could just stop donating. I don't know. It sounds like there's a lot of emotional stuff that's happening with this and you. And it also sounds like it really hasn't shaken out yet. It's not like you've come to terms with 100% of this just yet.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. You think I would. It's like almost been a whole year. But it's like, no, it's just getting started.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, a year? What? That's nothing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's cool that you could, like, you started a GitHub project and maintained it, and now it's your job. I think that's kind of
certainly. I would hope you have some pride of that. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's funny. Maybe it's like I'm focusing so much on even the present or the future, I forget like how far we've come. And yeah, it's
well. Let's do the past. Can we do the past? Maybe that's a little easier to talk about just right now. Like, wasn't there? I almost forget what the world was like before Babel, because at some point we wanted to use, okay, I got to set this up in a good way. I still think of Babel as a way to use new JavaScript before my browser targets are ready for it. Is that still the number one use case of Babel? Is that's how the world thinks of Babel, is like, I want to compile JavaScript to an older version of JavaScript. Is that the number one use case?
I guess it's hard to know because this gets into like analytics and stuff, but I think if you're talking in terms of like what do people think Babel is used for, then yes, I think people still think that is the whole goal of it. And I think it is. It's just we have expanded the scope of what that means, and like being able to do that allows you to do other things too. So
mm-hmm. So that gets tricky. And then before Babel came along, that did that. As one of the things that it does, I know it's gotten a little bit more complicated these days, but wasn't it Tracer or something? There's like other projects that seem like maybe they're still around, but you really don't hear them talked about in the community all that much anymore. And for whatever reason, Babel struck a chord and that's what it did. So what was it like in those early days? What was the point? What was the scope of the project? And what were you thinking about while you created the project? That kind of stuff.
Great. Yeah, I can go into that. Well, I guess first I'll say that it's funny. It's kind of like it's so ubiquitous now that people don't even think about it. It just like exists. A lot of times I meet people that don't even know the name because it's in some other tool, like say like Parcel or Webpack or Next.js or something. Like those tools include Babel by itself. So it's like there and people don't think about it. And then maybe that's why it's so hard for us to like raise funding or awareness, because it's almost like so used that it's like gone now, which is like a good thing in a way, where it's like it shouldn't be a thing you have to think about it, but it also makes it hard for us to talk about it. So first I guess I'll just say that like Babel is a compiler, and I would, in other terms, like non like programming terms, I would say it's a language translator, but the language happens to be programming languages. And history-wise, so actually, I didn't actually start Babel. It's funny because now that I'm the main person working on it, I think it's easy to assume that I made everything and stuff. But it was actually created by another engineer, Sebastian McKenzie. And right now he works at Facebook. And he also made a bunch of other tools that we all know, like Yarn and Lerna and Prepack and a lot of other things. And so, yeah, it was created, like the first commit, I think it was 2014, like September 28th.
And on that day, was it like, this is a new tool for writing future JavaScript?
Yeah, so no. He basically made it for fun. And he wanted to learn how languages worked. Like, he had some experience with JavaScript, but he never was like, how does this actually work? And then at that time, you know, people are trying to still learning about like what is ES6, and we didn't even call it ES6. I think we call it like ES Next or something. And you know, he's just curious about how things work. He has like just wants to learn that, and decided to like basically create, like you mentioned Tracer before, and so that I think that just came out at some point, and that was by Google. And he was like, "This is really cool. I want to like basically create my own." I think he said something like he has like this not invented here syndrome personally, which is good because it's like the curiosity asks you like, hey, you know, how does this work? I want to learn. I'm going to try to make it myself, which we don't have a lot of all the time, right?
And then what did it do? Was it because another way I think of it is like an AST creator kind of thing, right? Like it looks at a chunk of code and it turns it into tokens and stuff so that it can be programmatically worked with. Was that the original intent of that first commit?
Yeah. So the first, like, this actually goes into the name, right? So like, why is it called Babel now? When it first came out, it's actually called 6 to 5. It makes sense because all it literally did was convert ES6 to ES5. And so that was the point. It was literally just to convert that language.
Meaning you write a arrow function, it turns into a regular function. You write let, it turns to var or whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yep, exactly. Yep. And I think what happened was, you know, Tracer was already out, but I think, I might be wrong, but like, it was more of like a research type thing. They weren't intending people to like literally use it in production and like turn into this thing where we write that new syntax and then it compiles it automatically and you can pretend like you're already using it. I kind of think of Babel like jQuery in a way. Like jQuery let you write, you know, all this stuff and not have to think about the browser incompatibilities and stuff, right? It kind of like is a layer in between so that it works in like IE and Firefox and Chrome and all that. And Babel did the same thing, but actually for syntax.
Yeah, and people are excited about that because there's some global JavaScript mindset that's just like, I love this new syntax. I want to write in it right now. And if I need to put a tool in my build step to let me do that, I'm going to do it. And maybe that's the spirit even still today. I mean, I know we have ES5 code in our code base at CodePen that is like that on purpose because it needs to be for some old browser support stuff. But we're constantly like, oh, it'd be so nice to rewrite this and make sure that particular area of our code gets babelized. You know, so I think that spirit is still there. I still am excited about these things. But then it got more, didn't it? It just got deeper, right? Because people are, the language of JavaScript is constantly moving. It still is. I want to use promises now. I want to use whatever decorator functions, whatever those are. You know, there's all this. And so I'm sure on day one, it didn't support all that stuff, right? It just, that became.
Right.
And it turned into plugins eventually. Was plugins a later idea?
Yeah. So I would first say that I wasn't even involved actually until it was called Babel, which is pretty hilarious. So that's like way further in. So I'm assuming that, yeah, it didn't implement everything at first. You know, over time, people were asking for certain things. You know, if it's called 6 to 5, then the goal would be to implement as much of ES6 as possible. And eventually, well, it's like, well, there are like more features in the pipeline, right? So like ES, quote unquote, ES7, ES8, that kind of thing. And so then it's like, how do we implement that? And eventually it's like, wait, the way we implement those proposals or like arrow functions and stuff in Babel itself maybe they're just like files, and he realized, oh, we can make like a plugin system. So that was added, like, I think in like Battle 5 or something. And then through Battle 6, it was like, okay, now we have like presets where each plugin, like if a plugin is just one feature, like converting arrow functions, and you want to install that one thing, maybe you don't want to install like 10 things because you want all of them. So you can create your own preset, which is just basically, you could think of it as a config or an array of plugins.
Right. It just, it seems like a big deal, right? Because I don't know that I necessarily have the expertise to decide which 10 that I want.
Right. Yeah. And so either you can trust someone else's preset, like, hey, I like this, the way they do it, and I'm just going to use that. Or maybe you have one person at your company that handles that, and then you just use the same preset in all of your projects, which is helpful.
That's interesting. And what is the idea? I mean, pardon me if this is really basic stuff, but I, you know, it's just where I'm at, I guess, in my understanding of things. Is then that preset evolves too, right? So maybe the next time I yarn install or whatever, there's an update to the preset because JavaScript has just evolved a bit and those plugins have changed a bit, and I get those now too. So I have now like unlocked some new feature of JavaScript just by virtue of the preset changing.
Yeah, kind of. So the difference is that it's hard to, like, we can have docs and I give talks and stuff, but in the end, it's hard to get everyone to understand everything that it can do. And so there's a difference between the quote-unquote official presets that we create for people and the ones that you can make. So, you know, maybe you don't like what we have or you have a specific thing. You know, everyone can make their own preset and you can even publish it on NPM. And so if you use that and they update it and, you know, you update your NPM package JSON, then it'll get the new whatever changed in that preset. It could be a new plugin. It could be an update. It could remove a plugin. I mean, that gets into like more complicated things and like in terms of just like the idea of Semver and breaking changes. Because like say they add or they remove a plugin and you are using it, then that's technically a breaking change because now it's not compiling that thing. And so people have to be cognizant.
I mean, that comes up with us at CodePen all the time because we offer Babel and we want to offer a fairly liberal version of it that lets you play with lots of different stuff. But we do not allow you to configure it either. So we need to make these changes and we can't rely on anything that might just change overnight. So as we evolve and change things, we have to be really careful about that. So that's interesting. And I'm sure other big projects are like that too. Like, please don't change anything on me overnight. So they make their own config that they know that won't change.
Yep. Or you would have to make sure that every change is basically a major version.
So. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Jetpack. You know, the WordPress plugin that does all kinds of stuff for your self-hosted WordPress site. I use it on every single self-hosted WordPress site I have because I just love the feature set. One of the feature set things that's pretty cool is you just flip it on. You know, there's a bunch of these like light switch features in Jetpack where you're just like, do you want this? Yes. Switch it on. Now you have it. You know, it requires no configuration, no fancy stuff. And you just get some improvement from it. One of them is that they have like an image CDN called Photon. So if you have no image solution other than just like hosting your own images on your own website, you'll almost certainly benefit from this. You just flip it on and then your images are hosted on their CDN called Photon, which is already good because CDN hosted images are just an improvement, of course, but it helps optimize them. And you know, because your site already does responsive images anyway, you have that. I've talked about this before. They just improved this feature. They call it Site Accelerator now that does your images as well, but it's starting to host more and more files on their CDN for you. So this new one is that anything that ships with WordPress Core, any file that they can count on that is hosted in that way that your site uses for some reason, when you flip this feature on, is also CDN hosted now. So that's pretty cool. I'm going to run some tests pretty soon, I think, on like a self-hosted WordPress site with none of this stuff turned on, and then flip it on and see what kind of speed improvements are there, because they're definitely there, especially if you test in different locations around the world, farther away from your kind of home-based server and all that. So the new Site Accelerator feature in Jetpack 6.7, I've just been like, hey, cool. Hey, thanks for the help. And so what about these, what about the concept of stages? Isn't that something you tried to move away from? Is some people would just be like, I don't know, I just want it all. So give me stage zero, because that's, is, I think, can you explain the concept of stages? And even though you don't use them anymore, right? Or that was maybe a misstep? Mm-hmm.
Yep. So maybe you can link this in the show notes or something, but I wrote a blog post on the Babel blog basically explaining, like the title is something like removing the stage presets in Babel. Or
yeah, I have the link here, right? So I'm sure does go into it way more, but for
those I think it's a great question, because it doesn't, not just like about stages, but like why I decided to do that. And why did I decide to write a whole blog post? Because I knew there'd be some kind of backlash. So this has to go into like, I don't know, even just like JS fatigue and like configuration. You know, we have lots of different like views on the stuff where like, some people think that, you know, we shouldn't have config at all, and then you should just make the defaults. And other people think you should be able to configure everything. And other people are like, you know, you should have a good default, then maybe you can still override it. And like, there's a lot of opinions with that. And so the reason why we added stages is because TC39 itself, which is the committee of people that work on designing the language, stands for Technical Committee 39. Before ES6, there weren't this idea of stages, and the whole, like, it's funny, the whole specification of JavaScript was like in a Word document, and that was really bad, and eventually it got moved to GitHub. Yeah, no, it's crazy.
I guess that explains a lot, to be honest.
It's just, you know, updating to modern stuff.
Yeah, that's the way it is. And do they speak in the language of stages? That's how they talk about stuff?
Well, I guess the problem is, it's like, how do you, this gets into like, I guess, programming language theory, and like how do you know when something's ready to like, quote unquote, be standardized, right? You know, do you just get in a room with a bunch of people and they just vote on it and they're like, okay, I think we're good, and we'll just add it to JavaScript. And that's kind of it's good in the sense that like, okay, quote unquote, experts are there and they know the history, you know, they have context. They understand like language design, but that doesn't mean they know, like, they're not like developers, where they might not be developers, right? Maybe they're just like people that work on languages and they don't understand what it's like to write JavaScript like every day. And so the committee itself has grown so that it's not just like people that work on languages, but the implementers of the browsers, so like the engines like V8 and stuff, and then now also developers, right?
It's the same story, for the record, in CSS. You know, that like there's, you know, people, it's good to have a room full of people that represent lots of different interests. And it would really be a bummer if there's no just day-to-day authors in the room. So now there is, you know.
Right. There needs to be this diversity of like knowing, like, yeah, exactly, the different use cases and different viewpoints. And that makes it hard, because now everything makes, maybe it'll feel slower, or like, where are we going? Or there's no like direction, because everyone has their own viewpoint and it's not singular. But the stage idea is just that instead of going from like zero to one, where it's like, okay, zero is not in the language and one it's in the language, we have these intermediate steps. And I think of the steps in terms of like how confident that we want this feature to be in the language.
So if it's stage three, it's really close to being in the language, if not already in browsers. So.
Right. I mean, I guess it's kind of unfortunate that the stages are numbered, because, you know, obviously semantically it doesn't mean anything. But I can explain a little bit like on how some people think about the numbers. So stage zero is, I would essentially say that it's just an idea. And that means that if you're using stage zero, there is no like, you shouldn't be confident at all that this will be in the language. It's literally like if someone thought, hey, why don't we do this? And I'm going to present it to the committee.
Yeah.
There is no implementation.
That's like bootleg ideas, basically.
But it was super popular, wasn't it? I mean, people liked that because they want, their JavaScript people are crazy. They want weird stuff in their language.
I mean, I don't fault people for that, because it's like, you know, like, everyone always wants to use the new shiny thing, and they want to use it as soon as possible. It's just they don't really think about the consequences of doing that. And we didn't do a good job of like helping people think that way. It's kind of like you don't have to think about it. You're just like, I want the most convenient thing, the thing that has no config. It's like, I don't want to have to add every plugin myself, like, manually, so might as well just do stage zero. And there's a whole meme about, like, how, you know, you can just use stage zero, which is really funny.
But what's wild to me is that couldn't there be a massive change from what that idea was in stage zero to, let's say, it does get some adoption and people like it and it's starting to move towards being a real language thing? I mean, because we see this in CSS, there's an early idea, and then by the time it's further along and in the language, things have really changed with it. So if you wrote a bunch of code at stage zero, like, it might quite literally break your code when it moves up a step. Right?
Yes.
That feels
good. It's totally true. And it's like inherently that it will probably break. It's like very unlikely for something to, it's like, it's kind of like if your idea that you made right now is exactly what it's going to be later. It's like, how is that remotely possible?
Never ever happened.
Right? And so maybe the reason why it wasn't a big deal is because it just so happened that a lot of the things that we implemented didn't change that much. So I'm thinking of, like, class properties and object.
You got lucky early on.
Spread. Yeah. And so we have a really good example of this actually happening with decorators. This is, like, the epitome of the problem that we're talking about, where we had stage zero decorators implemented, and TypeScript implemented that too. And everyone started using it. It got adopted by, you know, various frameworks like Ember and other things, Angular. And so eventually, I think we implemented stage one, but then that's probably going to change too. And then, like, you know, stage two is going to change. So, like, then how do we, like, that's from the user side, it's already hard enough to, like, modify your code. But then from our point of view, like Babel, like, how do we create a system to allow people to continue to use the old thing, but also upgrade to the new thing? And that's, like, so complicated. It's, like, crazy. Like, do we create a new
option? It really sounds like a nightmare, you know?
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And we have this, you know, thousands of projects using it, and maybe even frameworks using it. And, like, how do we upgrade people to the next thing? Do we create code mods? Do we need guides? Like, all these things. But, you know, like, it is a nightmare, but in some sense, this is kind of like what Babel is for. Like, there are no tools that help you use new syntax before it's out. Like, it's almost like, why would you even waste your time doing it? Because it's going to change anyway. But this is kind of like the point of what I think, why is Babel special? Not just because of that, you know, compiling the old, new syntax to old, but, like, making that, you know, pre-new syntax, you know, proposal syntax, and influencing the language. Like, there are no, I think there aren't any other languages at all that would have this kind of concept, because you don't need it. Babel allows the community to be involved in the language design, in the sense they can use that new idea and then give feedback, and then eventually it should be better than if just the people that worked on the language in the community that made it, right? Like, if it was just them, it would turn out a lot differently than if they showed people, like, hey, this is an idea. And people are like, it's like, I think other languages, they might have a proposal, but that doesn't mean they're going to implement it, right? Like, with Babel, it's like, we can actually do it, you can use it, and you can give real feedback based on your actual usage versus, like, just thinking about it in your head.
Yeah, so in a sense, it really benefits the language evolving in a good way, because people got a chance to play with something really early in a way that didn't break anything. And it's just unfortunate. It's just it's kind of a small subset of the problem is when it does evolve, then how do you handle that? I mean, this also exists in CSS. It was kind of vendor prefixes, for example, are a big thing in CSS. And I think the industry smartly moved away from it, because the second they're available in browsers, people used it. And then by the second there's a critical mass of people using it, it can never change. So they're like, oh, we really need to stop putting those in browsers right away and have a different way for people to test out these features. And they went with feature flags and stuff. But crucially, there is no Babel of CSS, really. I think post-CSS is probably the closest, because people make little modules that try to replicate some future feature. But even that is, like, I think people realize is a little dangerous, because there's, like, okay, a post-CSS plugin that compiles down variables, those dash dash variables in CSS. Well, immediately they're not the same because they're being compiled down to regular CSS, and there's no way for a compiled down version of those to behave in the same way that they do naturally in the browser. So there's no, it's not like there isn't, you know, I just don't see there ever being a Babel of CSS because of the nature of it in a way. And if there was, it would just face all the same problems that you're facing, I would think.
Right. I think that's mostly because, like, maybe it's because there isn't an equivalent with the right behavior. A lot of the syntax in JavaScript is just sugar. And so mm-hmm. it is easy, well, quote unquote easy. Obviously, it's a lot of work to do it. But sometimes, you know, there is like a one-to-one transformation that you can make. There are things in JavaScript that we can't, you know, compile.
What about something like a promise? Is there some way to unpromisize a promise, some elaborate way to write ES5 JavaScript? I can't even wrap my mind around that, but I imagine there is, I guess.
So that's a good question. What I would say for that is that we need to differentiate between syntax and like this quote unquote like standard library. And so Babel only converts syntax where it's like a new like keyword or like class or arrow function. And I would say promise isn't actually a syntax, right? It's just a variable name that's a function. And so in that sense, if Babel sees promise, it actually doesn't do anything to it. It just assumes that it's there. And that's where the idea of like polyfills come in. Where a polyfill is just, you know, doing like promise equals something, you know, some implementation. And that has all the same problems where it's like maybe that polyfill had a bug and then now you're using that thing, or the browser version has a bug, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. But Babel helps you with your polyfills too or not? Or how do you, isn't there a thing called Babel polyfill?
It's not something that Babel originally did, but I figured that it makes sense to add it in. This goes into like preset env, but Babel polyfill is just it's a polyfill you can add, but like if anyone looks at the source code, it's just like two import statements. It's like import of core.js and regenerator, and core.js is a polyfill, and you don't have to use Babel polyfill. There's like all these options. We just do that because it has the name and like you can use it. I almost feel like we should deprecate it just because then people will understand that it's not anything special. It's just a name that substitutes for something else. But we'll figure it out.
You heard it here first, everybody. Henry has officially announced the deprecation. Just kidding. He didn't do that. But you might.
Maybe, yeah.
Fascinating.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is also brought to you by Netlify. At its core, Netlify is a static file host that makes it extremely easy to deploy sites. Just a command line entry, a commit to a repo, or even drag and drop. They do a lot of things you might think a static file host couldn't do, like allow your cloud functions to run, help you with processing forms, and even help with authenticating your users. When I'm not editing ShopTalk Show, I run a podcast network and we're using Netlify to host the entire site, other than the MP3 files, of course. Their free plan is a great way to start out a personal website or project. I recently set up a new blog for podcasters using Netlify and Gatsby, all from the click of a button. By using Netlify's DNS for my domain, I'm able to share and preview branches of changes to the site before going live. They call it automatic branch subdomains, something I honestly wouldn't have ever bothered to set up or configure without Netlify. So follow the link on the episode page or the chapter marker in your podcast player and check out Netlify for your next project. Our thanks to Netlify for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Okay, this is such great background. Dave, what's on your mind right now?
You know, I think you've had already some success like migrating people to like the preset env preset, right? Wasn't I maybe that this is last year's news, but
it does sound like a success story though.
But wasn't it was kind of like an issue, right? Everyone was on Babel preset 2015 or something, and you're like, let's move to env. And I'm sure like things like create React app and things like that had that built in sort of helped that. But can you kind of like, what was that like to move? I'm thinking like millions of users over to something new. You know what I mean?
That's actually, yeah. I haven't really thought. That's a good point, actually. It's like, it is really hard for people to upgrade. And I kind of just gloss over the fact that, yeah, we were able to finally do that. Like, one way of knowing this is looking at like our NPM downloads. Like you would check like BAML preset ES2015 and then checking the amount for preset ENV. And at some point, it was like higher like downloads for ENV, which is great. There's a lot of things I could say about that. Like, so we talked about presets. And at first, we created BAML preset ES2015, which is basically ES6, because we knew that, you know, if you're going to use BAML for ES6, why would you want to ask people to add each plugin individually when they probably want all of them, right? And so we added that. And then eventually it's like, well, what are we going to do about next year? And so I made like 2016, 2017. And that was fine for a while. And then I was like, wait, why would you need to do that every year? Right? It's like, it's just going to get bigger over time as well. So then I made something called like BAML preset latest, which was, and that was like, oh, naming is so hard. It's like, what do we call the thing that is just all the years combined that are not the proposals? So I was like, you know, is it latest? Is it like standard or like all these things?
Because there's some metric of success. If you get it wrong, maybe it doesn't click with people as well. It's not as adopted.
Just saying that, it makes me realize like every time I NPM install and let's say BAML updates or something like that, there's a chance I get like a whole new ENV, right? ES2019 snuck in there and now I have all those features. Is that kind of how it works?
Yes, in the sense that it's new, like it'll be there because it's not a breaking change to add it in, right? Because you're not using that syntax, it won't break. So we might as well add in the new stuff. It's just, you know, it's hard to, it goes back to like communication on like, how do we get people to do the best practice to understand what the new features are, how to use them effectively, you know, what the trade-offs are, all that stuff. And like, we've never really had a good job of that, but I think it's obviously a really hard problem. And it's hard to do that through the tooling. Like, you know, do we do it through the command line? Are people even looking at that? If we do it on Twitter, that's only a certain subset of people, like on GitHub as well. It's like, you know, it's hard to like communicate to our user base when I don't even know how they're using it, right? It's like, are they using it through a different tool? Should we instead be talking to the tooling people, like the frameworks, and then through them, it goes to other people? And at the same time, there are people that are like writing articles and videos that are about BAML and might not even be correct because they didn't like, they just like found that out by themselves or something like that.
That's got to be tricky too, because it is such a big name, of course. Surely there's like lynda.com videos that go all into it that you had no idea was even happening.
Yeah.
Not to call out them specifically. I have no idea.
Yeah.
As an example.
Right.
Yeah. Totally unrelated. I was like, oh, I want to like consume an API in Vue. Like, let me just look for examples. And somebody like in a Vue method, like the created method, they like spin up like a XML HTTP request like inside that. That was like their way to solve, like, which is fine and correct. It works. But I was like, you can use Fetch. There's no reason, or Axios or something modern. I don't know. It was really, anyway, there's a lot of bad code out there.
I got a question about this because I wonder if it's like another, if this is like not a big deal for BAML or a really big deal. One of them is that I've stopped supporting, let's say on my project, all versions of IE. Like when I look at my browser support target, I can start shipping ES6 and I kind of want to because I've read, when we don't compile down to ES2015 or whatever it is, it's faster, it's better. The browser digests that stuff better, can optimize it better. So I want to still use BAML because for some reason I have to. Let's say I'm using JSX, which is another whole thing I want to ask you about. Like, I wonder if transformations like that are just as big of a deal for BAML as like convert new JavaScript to old JavaScript stuff. Mm-hmm. But like now I want to configure my BAML to just leave my arrow functions alone. How are you dealing with that? Does preset env already there? Is it already past that point where it has stopped transforming arrow functions or not quite?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's exactly what preset env helps you do. I feel like I can just talk about everything. So after we did preset latest, I figured, you know, at some point, like what you're saying, browsers will implement the features that BAML will implement, right? they're just lagging behind because it takes longer for it to get standardized, and it also takes longer to write that code in C++ and ship it in the browser. And so eventually, you know, Chrome and basically every browser now, they all support arrow functions that are modern, at least, not IE. And then I was thinking, well, I want to help people transition, you know, I guess, quote unquote, off of Babel. But in some sense, it's kind of like the question of like, when do I not need to use Babel anymore? But it's kind of like, it's not have really not using Babel.
Uh-huh. It's never, right, in a way, because there'll always be new stuff you want to do.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like, it's kind of a weird question to ask, because it's like, if you're using it now, you wanted to use it for some new fancy syntax. There's always going to be some new fancy syntax that you want to use. So why wouldn't you want to use Babel with it? And so it's, I think in that sense, it'll always be used, but it'll just turn off the old transforms and you'll turn on new ones. And preset ENV should help you with that and do that automatically. The way that works is that we have, you could think of it as like a giant Excel sheet of every feature or plugin, and then every browser and which version that they started supporting it at. And then when you're using preset ENV, it by default compiles everything to the lowest like common denominator. So it'll compile all the arrow functions to regular functions. But if you say like what browsers you support explicitly, then it knows like, oh, all these browsers already support it, so I'll just turn it off. Right? It's just like an on and off switch for all that stuff.
Wonderful. I mean, what a great idea, right?
Yeah. And so that happened. I don't even remember when I made that. So I think that was the only thing I actually like created. Everything else is just like maintaining. but that in itself, I mean, that could be its own full-time thing. Like, how do you manage that whole like system and making sure it works? And that can create its own set of bugs, obviously. But yeah, that I think it's really helpful because now it helps people transition to not just thinking about JavaScript in terms of ES6, but like just thinking about JavaScript beyond, like in the future of we're always going to add new things to JavaScript. Browsers are always going to implement new features eventually. Babel will implement new features, and then you will eventually drop old browsers. And like, there's like four different things, all these variables, and we need to figure out like the smallest amount of code that we should send to the browser, and then Babel can help you with that.
You have this two-sided problem that's interesting. Like, it's like if we think about SAS, the CSS compiler, they don't really have to care how the language of CSS evolves. They have to a little bit because they need to compile stuff that's compatible with that, or if there's some new weird syntax, they have to make sure it doesn't choke in the SAS compiler. But when they ship a feature, they say, we think this feature is going to be good for CSS authors. It's our invented syntax that we intend to support, not something that needs to be in the core language. It will just always be that way. This is our version of variables that we support. Like, you, it's too late now, but you could have done that in the early days. Say, like, we just think this is a good thing for the JavaScript language. This is how we're going to do it. And we'll always compile it to what the native browser does, but this is just our idea that we'll support. And that's not where you're going. You're saying, we want to support where the language is going to go, you know, kind of on both sides.
Yeah, I think that is very unique, like you said. Like, yeah. if we did one way, then we would just be another language, right? Like Elm or PureScript or Reason or any of those things. Those are just languages that people, that they have their own standard. They can do whatever they want, and they compile it down to JavaScript. And it's funny, in that sense, like, I was just hearing about Dart. They're going to try to compile to like more modern syntax instead of ES5. And then their suggestion is that if you need ES5, you can use Babel. So in that sense, Babel supports every other language that compiles to JavaScript because they might not compile all the way down to the lowest, right? They just want to compile to
And because
that.
You're open source, you can't be like, that's a great idea, Dart. I'll offer that to you for $10,000 a month.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for the rec, Dart.
Not quite.
This sort of gets me into just the scope of Babel. One thing, you know, I think originally I struggled with like, okay, it's changing my syntax, but like I'm not getting the features. So, and you kind of covered that. Like, it's not the polyfill. It's not really polyfills. It's just a syntax. It broadens your syntax compatibility, which mm-hmm. I think is really sweet. But another kind of core feature of Babel are these plugins. And, you know, I think I always struggle with, oh, like, why isn't this working? And it's like, oh, you dummy, you didn't install Babel React, mm-hmm. some weird thing style component plugin transform, mm-hmm. you idiot. And then it's like, oh yeah, of course I didn't. So I'm kind of like, can you give us a scope of that like plugin ecosystem? Like how many plugins are there? And then like what, how many plugins, I don't know, does the average build kind of employ?
Yeah. I guess first I'll mention about the polyfill thing. So Babel doesn't transform polyfills, but because of PrecedentNV, we know which browsers support what, like which browser, like what version of what browser supports like promise. And then we can use that to turn on or turn off adding the polyfill for you. So that's like another thing that it does automatically.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay, so plugins. It's another analytics problem that is like hard to know. Like I don't know how many plugins there are other than looking at npm. So you can just go to npm, I'll search like Babel dash plugin, and I see like say like 3,000 results. So there's like a lot. I mean, that doesn't mean like all of them you should use all of them, or like maybe like I'm sure like 100 of them are just our plugins, right? So there's a lot.
JSX has to be a huge one, doesn't it? Like that's how the, if you write JSX, you probably use Babel to un-JSX it, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's just the amount of plugins. And I think it's funny in the sense that like, I don't think it's a bad thing that there's so many. It doesn't mean everyone's using all of them. But there's also a weird thing where it's like, are people just adding random plugins because they feel like it? And then that's causing bugs. And then that goes back to us. It's like, oh, why does this work? It's because you're using this plugin.
I always thought of that as a combination of why, of SAS versus post CSS. SAS, if you use it, you just use it for the most part. Not, like the ecosystem largely, there's some plugins and stuff, but they're not really like core alterations of what it does. Whereas post CSS does nothing by itself. Like, it, I mean, right. I don't know if that's similar with Babel. You have to add little pieces of it to do it, which means that every single project on earth that uses post CSS has hand pieced together all the little plugins mm-hmm. that they use. And I don't know what that means for the larger ecosystem of them, but it's weird. It's certainly like, I don't know. It means every code base is a little different.
Right. And I think like, there are a few things that are like, I don't like the fact that we have so many plugins either. It's not like, like I want people to configure everything. I wish it was really simple too. I just don't know the best trade-off on how to have a really good default and then also somehow enabling people to add plugins and make it easy. Like I don't want it to be hard to use Babel at all. And also I don't want to force people to use Babel either. Like people like feel bad they're not using it. It's like, you never have to use it. Like, it's an optional thing. If you don't want to write that kind of code, then you don't, right? It's just hard to like get that balance of like all those things.
Well, and like you said at the top of the show, like a lot of people aren't using just Babel right now. Mm-hmm. They're probably using it through another interface,
right.
Probably Webpack or Parcel or something. So, you know, I think, yeah, like you copy pasted some config you found on Stack Overflow and it's got some transforms that are happening and it's, you know, it's all seems tough to figure out what's happening.
Yeah. There's like multiple layers to it. It's like, do we add new docs? Do we make it easier? Are we supposed to like reach out to the tool people? And do people even configure it themselves? It's just like weird to figure out exactly how to do how to do it the right way without, I guess, pissing people off, which is weird. Like, it almost feels like everything we do is going to piss people off. Or I just keep seeing the negative stuff, and I only hear positive stuff when I, like, talk to people in person. Like, I go to a conference, and everyone's like, wow, thanks for all your work. And I'm like, dang, this is great. And then you go online, and everything's, like, negative.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I'm sure I've contributed to that. I have a question, and you've patiently worked with issues for me specifically, so I appreciate that. I want to get into that, like maintaining, because I feel like that's like a big thing you do, and like you're maintaining this repo for millions of developers, it seems. You know, I'm sure that's like stressful, but like I think we had a conversation at a conference once, and you're just kind of like, you know, oh yeah, like Microsoft did this giant PR on me to like support all of TypeScript or something like that. And but you're like, and now it'll take me a month or something to get through. And you're just kind of like, you know, that's a lot of work and time and money and all that. And so like, yeah, I think you've settled on a kind of a Patreon-y mm-hmm. sort of approach, or what I think there's another way, open source initiative or something.
But, open collective. Yeah.
Open collective. Yeah. But like what, I guess, how's that? What's the state of being a maintainer here in 2019?
Yeah. I mean, even using that example, like, obviously it's really cool that, you know, the TypeScript team made that all those PRs. But I mean, and in some sense, obviously it helps them because it's about getting their adoption higher. And they're really great too. And I love working with them. It's just in the end, you know, they have a whole team of people that are funded by a big company to do this full time. And then we have a bunch of volunteers. And it's kind of like, well, when am I going to prioritize doing this or that? Or instead of like spending a lot of time reviewing, I'll just merge it anyway and then just see what happens because I just don't have enough time. And then when the bugs come in, you get
the what is it, event stream problem possibly.
Right. And that, yeah, you might be like, well, we only have six people. So like, you know, should I start adding people? And then now the worst part is like when stuff like event stream happens, it kind of makes every maintainer more cautious into adding people, which is not a bad thing, right? In some sense, because we don't want that to happen again. But it might get you a little bit more paranoid about like, oh, maybe I should wait longer for them to get added, or I have to like vet them and stuff. And it's like, yeah, we're all vetting people all the time, but how do you know when to trust somebody? Like they could be like working for a whole year on something, and then at the end they decide to do something bad. And you can't like fault yourself for that, right? You can't fault that guy for like wanting to do that. And it's hard. And you only do that because you feel like you need to add more people, or you don't have enough money to do it yourself. I mean, even getting paid full time to do it, I'm not gonna like spend all my time reviewing PRs, because at this point, like talking about maintenance now, it's like, is that really the best use of my time? Like, if all I did was look at issues and fix bugs, I don't think the project's gonna move forward because no one else is really thinking about that. And so I'm finding myself, I guess, in the last months, thinking, yeah, maybe that quote unquote leadership management thing is more important, because we're thinking long term, right? We don't want to just take out the fires, but figure out like where is this project going and stuff like that.
You're in good company. I think that's everybody eventually struggles with that, especially as you're years and years deep into a project. In the early days, it's just different. You're just like, oh, this is cool and fun. I'm going to do this. And then you're years and years deep into this important project that serves a lot of people. And you need to think about, where is this thing going? Why are we doing? What are we doing here? Who's steering the ship? You know, it's, I only mention that to say, you know, I know it's stressful. There's no answer to the stress, but it's also you're not alone.
Yeah, no, I think that's important to know. Like sometimes it's better to know that there isn't really an answer, because I guess for any entrepreneurial thing, especially for open source, I guess, because there are a few people doing it full time without a company, there isn't really a lot of people to look up to. And there's no like, I can't read some book and it'll tell me what to do either. It's kind of like in some weird way, people are looking to me to figure it out. And like, I don't know.
No, I mean, because on the surface, all features sound great, you know, to any kind of project or repo. But then it could also, you know, one overcommitment could kind of break the camel's back, so to speak. It could really overburden the project, or, you know, crash performance or any kind of thing. So it's tough work.
Yeah. And I guess into maintenance, like adding a feature doesn't mean adding that PR. It means supporting it forever, right? And if it's something like adding, say, TypeScript, it doesn't mean that we're adding the current version of TypeScript. We're adding all of it. And that's also a commitment on their team's part too, obviously, because if Babel only supports part of it, then it's going to look bad for them anyway. So it's a good thing in that sense. Like, we're working together. It's just that on our side, we still need people to work on it. And that's another thing that we have to think about. Everything we add is another piece of scope. I mean, I think it's worth doing, and obviously like hearing about all these people that are switching to it, the reason why they're able to switch to it is because of this feature. So
yeah, well, I mean, I think I like saw like Dan Abramov from React kind of tweeting about like, you know, you can, he said something about like code modding, you know, like when you just code mod whatever anyway, like just kind of, hey, it's a given, you're code modding, you're throwing it through Babel and changing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man, I mean, I don't always code mod everything, but like, I guess most people probably do. And even to the point, I was like, you know, you could probably write in like Swift or Objective-C and run it through some kind of transform to get JavaScript out at the end. I mean, it wouldn't be impossible. It would be, or you could even whatever, talk like a pirate script or something, mm-hmm. and just it could transpile to a actual JavaScript. So it's, I don't know, it's a lot of work there. So that's all to say, like, it's just kind of incredible what people are using it all for.
Yeah. How should we wrap this up best? I should say Henry's got a Patreon. If the entire Shop Talk Show audience could head over there, that'd probably, I'm sure Henry would appreciate that. He also has a new podcast.
If we all gave $1 mm-hmm. to Henry right now, committed $1,
I know,
he would be rich.
What is Henry going to do with those extra $7?
I know. Seven whole dollars a month from Shop Talk. Just, there you go. but yeah, Henry, thank you so much for coming on the show. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
You can donate to the Patreon. It's patreon.com/HenryZhu. But that's if you want to donate to me individually. You don't have to do that. You can also donate to our Babel. So we have an open collective, which is opencollective.com/Babel. I think, like, I don't have that much money on Patreon, and I don't know exactly why, but it makes sense that we have a lot more on Open Collective, because from a company point of view, it like looks good to like say like, oh, our company is supporting Babel. Like, it doesn't, like, it would be weird if someone's like, oh, we're donating to Henry, even though I'm the one working on it. And so if you're a company or you work at a company, then yeah, you can look into that. We actually have a lot of sponsors now. So like even AMP, which is a part of Google, they just they just donated like $2,000 a month for this year, so $24,000.
There you go, companies. Yeah. Look at that as an example. I mean, AMP. There you go. You're welcome.
And we have other companies too, like Facebook. They're donating like $1,000 a month, but and you know, various companies. It's just funny that like, it's almost like the company that donates the most, it kind of sets the bar for people. It's like, well, why aren't you donating? Why are you only donating like 100? You should donate that much too.
So I like know. Price is right rules. More, if you want to make a difference, you have to donate at least $2,001 a month.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it's like a increasing cycle, not just for Babel, right? For other projects too. It's like, how do we make it normal for like companies to donate back and stuff, right? Instead of just being like just for us. It's like, if we're only making a certain amount, then every other project is making like 100 times less. So we need to be more visible so that it becomes a normal thing for everyone to donate.
I think that's true. I feel like, you know, I'm sure there's a NPM plugin that does it, but just analyzes your like bundles, you know, and just is like, hey, here's a bunch of links. Like, here's what you should do. Cause it would just be, I don't know. Be just. Nice. I think most people listening to this podcast probably have a something that depends on Babel. And if we all gave $2, it would be $2 a month. It'd be no problem. So
I wish there was some way to make it like compile like 0.001% better somehow. If you're a contributor, that'd be nice.
I mean, we could totally do that, but I don't know if we would want to.
Okay.
We're talking $24 a year, the price of a Blu-ray to write future JavaScript. No big deal. This is great. This is worth it.
Well, Dave, I know you got to run, so, and I do.
Yeah, I got to go. I have a hard stop, but thank you, Henry, and please follow him on Twitter. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And I think we have a special announcement related to that.
Hey, we got a job opening to let you know about. Actually, two of them, and it's at Clock. That's clock.co.uk. They're an award-winning agency in Hertfordshire over in the UK. They have all kinds of prestigious clients like News UK, Riot Games, and you'll be working on big digital marketing campaigns with them. So it's just the kind of people that, you know, probably listen to this show. Extensive knowledge of semantic HTML and CSS, experience using JavaScript, ideally, you know, some React in there would be good. You know, you're familiar with Git and GitHub and UX, and you're a detailed kind of person. At least a couple years experience. They're asking about preprocessors like Sass and Less, you know, generally familiar with CSS architecture kind of things. You know, just the kind of stuff we talk about on this show. Hit them up. You know, it's just such a beautiful place over there and such a cool company. Again, that's clock.co.uk, but come over to our show notes to find a link right to this exact job position so you know how to apply.
And thank you for listening. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, shoptalkshow.com.